From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The phones went dead in several cities earlier this summer because of a computer problem. On today's Fresh Air, we discuss the new problems that are accompanying our new advances in computer technology. Also today, golf. Many of today's new courses are being designed into housing communities. John Struan tells us about how golf is affecting everything from real estate prices to the environment. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the latest album from pianist Dubravka Tomsic. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new series from horror writer Stephen King. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The leaders of the world's seven largest industrial nations issued a political communique at their G7 summit in London today. In it, they comment on a wide range of issues, including the Middle East peace process. NPR's John Idsty reports.
The summit leaders attempted to give a boost to a new round of Middle East diplomacy by U.S. Secretary of State James Baker, which will begin immediately after this summit is completed. They gave their support for parallel peace talks between Israel and the Palestinians and Israel and its Arab neighbors. British Foreign Secretary Douglas Hurd, who presented the political communique, outlined confidence-building measures which the leaders suggested to help move the process forward.
One, the suspending of the Arab boycott of Israel by Arab states, and secondly, the Israeli policy of building settlements in the occupied territories.
Hopes for a breakthrough in the Middle East have been raised because Syrian President Hafez Assad offered his support for a peace conference earlier this week. I'm John Idsty in London.
The leaders of the G7 nations also expressed support today for Mikhail Gorbachev's efforts at reform in the Soviet Union. The Soviet president arrived in London today. He's to meet with the G7 leaders tomorrow to make a personal appeal for help in solving the Soviet economic crisis. The G7 leaders were at work today on a plan to help the Soviets. One element of that plan would give the Soviet Union a special relationship with the International Monetary Fund. That status could ease the process of making the Soviet ruble convertible on world currency markets. The Senate Intelligence Committee has decided to delay confirmation hearings for Robert Gates, President Bush's choice to head the CIA. Over the next 2 months, the committee will instead focus on whether Gates had knowledge of the Iran-Contra affair. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
President Bush, only 4 days ago, defended Gates and demanded that confirmation hearings begin immediately, despite new revelations that top agency officials had knowledge of Oliver North's network supplying guns to Nicaraguan rebels. But the panel, with a nod from the White House, today announced that the hearings would be delayed until September 16th. The committee has also extended limited immunity to Alan Fiers, the agency official who shed new light recently on an agency cover-up of the Iran-Contra affair. Senate Intelligence Committee Chairman David Boren says, depending on what the committee learns from Fiers, subpoenas may be issued to other top officials at the CIA during the Iran-Contra period. Boren said today the nomination is not in trouble. He said there's nothing at this point in time, and I underline at this point in time, that would be disqualifying. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 7 points to close at 2,983.9. This is NPR News. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney presented Congress today with a classified analysis of the lessons learned during the Persian Gulf War. Cheney told reporters that although the United States dominated the fighting with its high-tech weaponry, there were problems in transporting troops and materiel to the Gulf. He said that more transport ships and aircraft would be needed in the future. The report said that the Allies were fortunate to have 6 months to gather troops in the region before the fighting actually began. In Mexico, a new outbreak of cholera has been reported in the state of Veracruz. Sandina Robbins has this report.
20 people have reportedly been infected with the highly contagious cholera bacteria in the mountainous region of Veracruz, located some 300 miles northeast of Mexico City. Authorities have been evasive about admitting the presence of cholera in the country, but an extensive public awareness campaign is underway, warning people to take additional precautions in personal hygiene and food preparation. Recent cases of cholera have also been reported in other parts of Mexico, and several deaths have been attributed to the infectious disease. While government authorities here claim to be taking the necessary steps to prevent further outbreaks, unsanitary conditions such as the lack of clean drinking water and sewage systems make stopping the spread of cholera an uphill battle. For National Public Radio, I'm Sandina Robbins in Mexico City.
Iraq appealed to Egypt today for support in its demand to have Arab experts examine its nuclear facilities. The Iraqi government has asked the Arab League to call a conference of ministers to discuss allied threats to attack Iraqi military sites if Iraq doesn't fully cooperate with UN site inspections. Yesterday, Britain joined the United States and France in saying that it would be prepared to support airstrikes against Iraq if the Iraqi government continues to hide its nuclear programs. Iraq has asked Egypt to support its demand for an Arab inspection team. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The phone system stopped working for a few hours a couple of weeks ago in several American cities. The diagnosis? A computer problem. And this interview is about what the problem was and how similar computer problems might affect you in the future. You have my word, we won't use any confusing high-tech lingo in this interview. The only fancy word you need to know is computer software. Computer software is the technical term for the instructions a computer is programmed to follow. And as our computer software gets more complex, there's more room for error, the kind of error that caused the phones to fail. My guest Leonard Lee is the author of a book about the new problems that have accompanied our new advances in software. It's called The Day the Phone Stopped. The title refers to January 15, 1990, when half the long-distance lines around the nation were disabled because of one tiny error in a software program. Coincidentally, right when Lee's book hit the stores 3 weeks ago, the phones stopped again. I asked Lee to explain what happened this time.
What happened was on June 26th, phones in two cities, Los Angeles and most of the Washington, D.C. area, including the surrounding areas of Maryland, West Virginia, and Virginia, pretty much just had their phones go strictly out of commission. People who tried to make phone calls within their area code either got a very fast busy signal or got one of those infamous your call cannot be connected as dial recordings. Their phones pretty much were useless for calling within the city. And then a couple days later, on July 1st, it happened again. This time it struck in San Francisco, Pittsburgh, and Greensboro, North Carolina. And altogether, 12 million people had their phones knocked out in one of these five incidents. And the effects, to put it bluntly, were quite devastating. It's one of these things where you don't realize how important something is until it's gone. A lot of people in these cities didn't realize how much we depend on the telephone these days until you lose it for 8 or 9 hours. Everything from pizza delivery places to stock brokerages could no longer communicate with their customers, and they lost a tremendous amount of business. One stock broker in the Washington, D.C. area said he estimates he lost $25,000 in business just during the 7 hours that his phones were out. And, of course, aside from the business communications, personal communications were also cut off. People could not get in touch with their doctors to consult on medical situations. Parents could not contact daycare centers. So aside from the dollar losses, it caused a lot of anxiety in people in these five cities, certainly. And so it was a kind of, I think, a shocking revelation to people to be confronted with this and realize how important reliable communications are.
What was the problem within the phone system?
Well, that's where the irony of the situation comes in. Nothing was broken in the phone system, really. There was no mechanical problem. Where the failure came, and this is kind of where we get into the era of we're experiencing a new technological nightmare, is because we had a problem in what's called the software programming, the instructions that tell the computers what to do. The situation we had in these five cities was this. Each of the local phone companies in these cities was putting in a new piece of computer programming, a program that would tell the phone companies switching computers how to route the telephone calls. Well, these programs, if you were to spit it out on paper, is about 2 million lines long. And to give you some sort of perspective for that, it's the equivalent of two Manhattan White Pages. Now, in those two Manhattan White Pages, somebody had left out two lines, you know, pretty insignificant error. But what happened was those particular two missing lines obviously were very critical at some point or other to making these phone switching computers work correctly. So on those particular days, the computers ran into a situation where they needed to use those two missing lines. They weren't there, and so the computer suddenly didn't know what to do, and so it simply shut down the system and didn't let anybody complete their calls from that point on.
Now, this is where we get into a different kind of problem than we're used to when we think of computer problems. We're used to thinking that, you know, the computer broke, you know, that something
right.
went wrong with the computer. But in this case, the computer's following the instructions in the computer software, but the instructions were written wrong.
Precisely. You know, computers are very smart machines on the one hand. They'll do whatever you tell them to do, and they'll do it very well. But at the same time, they're also kind of dumb. A computer will only do what you tell it to do. So in each instance, the computer needs to be told precisely what it has to do. And the problem we're running into is that these computers are becoming so complicated that nobody can anticipate every possible situation that the computer is going to run into. And so sooner or later, what happens is the computer runs into a situation where nobody told it exactly what to do. And so then the computer will either do the wrong thing or it will do nothing and say, hey, nobody told me what to do about this. And either way, you run into some trouble. And this is a very modern phenomenon. It's kind of the price we pay for the modern electronic age. In the old days, and I'm not saying we should go back to the old days because things weren't always great back then either, but maybe the one advantage we had was that, say, if you ran a factory or something, you could anticipate breakdowns to some extent. If you ran a factory, say you would know that maybe the bearings in your machine tool would need to be replaced every 50,000 hours and you'd need to replace the machine every year and a half. And you'd have spare parts ready because you knew which parts were prone to break down. The problem with all these new computer systems is you don't know when it's going to break down, you don't know where it's going to break down or what the effects are going to be, and so you're really kind of helpless in terms of you don't know when these problems are going to strike.
Are we in a new era of computer problems? Is software having more problems than it used to just a few years ago?
The situation is this. Computers are advancing at a rate, the experts tell me, of about 15% a year, which means it doubles roughly every 6 years or so. They're just accelerating at an enormous rate. So while computer hardware advances at about 15% a year, the software or programming is advancing only at about 3 or 4% a year. So what that means is that the computer programming is falling behind the advances in computer hardware. So this gap that's developing is growing, and so I think that unless we get a handle on it, we're going to see more of these problems in the future. The problem's probably going to get worse.
Well, let's look at the airline industry, for instance. You say that in airlines, computer software makes air travel safer, but at the same time, computer software also makes air travel more dangerous. That seems like a contradiction.
It is, and that's one of the modern paradoxes we're running into, that these days modern jetliners are crammed with computers. They run the engines, they run the galley ovens, they run just about everything. And so the problem you run into is that in some instances they make it much safer. They reduce the pilot's workload. They make things much easier in the cockpit. You don't need as many people to run the plane. And in that sense, it becomes much safer. The flip side of the coin, however, is that these computer systems, when they break down, often leave the pilot helpless. And when the computer breaks down in some of these modern jetliners, the pilot essentially becomes a passenger, and there's not much he can do because the computer's running the plane, and if it malfunctions, oftentimes there aren't backups for these systems. You know, I don't want to scare people and say, oh, no, the computer's going to fail and the plane's going to fall out of the sky. But I think what we have to step back and examine is what's the adequate trade-off? If you put more computers into these airplanes, does it actually make them safer? Or are we simply setting ourselves up for a new type of hazard? What we're witnessing these days, I think, is that we're seeing fewer accidents because of mechanical problems. You don't quite see the plane breaking down and causing problems that way. But we're seeing a new sort of phenomenon where the plane crashes even though everything is working correctly, that what happens is that either the computer malfunctions or the pilot, and this happens a lot, misinterprets the information from the computer, that somehow there's some sort of a problem in getting the information from the computer to the pilot, and so the pilot simply, in some instances, flies the plane into the ground. That we've seen some accidents, I think, already, where the pilot was relying on the computer to fly the plane, and so the pilot was thinking, well, gee, if the computer is taking care of the plane, everything must be all right, but everything wasn't all right, and so they ended up having an accident merely because the pilot was assuming, well, if I let the computer fly the plane, everything should be okay. And so I think we have to watch out for some of these new hazards, and I'm not quite sure that the industry is fully aware of this. They are taking some steps, but I think we really have to watch out for some of these new hazards that are being created and make sure they don't get out of hand.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is Leonard Lee. He's the author of the new book, The Day the Phone Stopped, The Computer Crisis. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about some of the latest problems that we've been experiencing because of computers and computer software, and my guest is Leonard Lee, author of the new book, The Day the Phone Stopped, The Computer Crisis. Let's look at some of the other areas in which computers and computer software are leaving more room for error. In the area of medicine, an example you give in your book is radiation therapy. Sometimes, rarely, but sometimes that goes wrong because of computer problems.
That's one of the scariest things that I encountered when I was researching the book, was that back in 1986, three patients died in Texas and Canada of radiation overdoses because there was a computer software programming error in a particular radiation therapy machine. And this, I think, shows two things. One, how dangerous computer errors can be sometimes when you use them in very critical situations, like in medicine. And the other thing is that how you can't really predict these errors. This particular machine had worked fine for years in more than two dozen installations around the U.S. And so people had come to rely on this machine, but all of a sudden there was one particular tiny error that suddenly in 1987 sprang to life and caused these three malfunctions. And this is a concern that seems to be growing. In 1989, the Food and Drug Administration had to recall 34 different computerized medical devices, much of it because of problems in the software programming. And that figure of recalls they had tripled in only 5 years. And again, I'm not trying to say, you know, we shouldn't move ahead with computers in this area because they allow you to do a lot more things and are responsible for some great advances in medical treatment. And so you can get tremendous benefits when you put computers into these devices. All I'm saying is I think we have to be a little more careful in making sure that these are tested properly and developed properly, and that we have the proper government regulatory oversight to try and minimize these types of problems.
Let's use the example again of the recent telephone system problems that several states experienced. When they finally figured out that the problem wasn't a computer virus, but it was just the way the software was written, it was in the software itself. I mean, how do you find out where the problem is? If the instructions that the computer is following is so long and so complicated, how do you find the problem?
Tracking down these problems would probably tax Sherlock Holmes. It makes the needle in the hay, looking for a needle in the haystack easy by comparison. Look at it this way: the particular computer program that malfunctioned in the phone systems was about 2.1 million lines long, and that's equivalent to two or three Los Angeles telephone books. Now, imagine trying to look through three LA telephone books and trying to find a missing dot over a single I. And that gives you some idea how tough it is to track down these things. They're tremendously complicated, And it takes a lot of good sleuth work to track it down. And again, that's part of the problem, is that these systems are more reliable. I don't want to knock them. They are very good systems when they work. But the flip side is, when they fail, it's a hellacious job to try and track down exactly where it went wrong.
You have an example in your book, which I'm going to ask you to share with everybody, and that's an example of why it's so difficult to write a computer program. And you compare writing a computer program to giving a friend directions how to get to your house.
Sure. You know, if you were to tell a friend how to get to your house, you might think it's easy. You might tell them, well, okay, go down to the third stoplight, take a left, go north on Bridge Street, and go down 5 blocks. But let's make it a little more complicated. Let's say you have to tell your friend how to drive from his house, which is in Seattle, down to your house in Miami. And you literally have to instruct them every single curve, every single stoplight, stop sign. What do they do? Do they go straight? Do they go left? How far do they go? Now let's make it even more complicated. Let's say you have to define all your terms. You have to tell them, well, what do you mean by north? How long is a city block? How long is a mile? Now let's make it a little more complicated. Let's assume this person knows nothing. You have to tell them how to drive a car. Okay, even worse. You have to explain to them, what is a car? Now try and sit down and give your friend directions on how to get from Seattle to your house in Miami. That's essentially what you have to do when you program a computer. Because when you start with a computer, it's a blank sheet of paper. It'll do whatever you tell it to do, but when you start out, the computer knows zip, absolutely nothing. So say you have to write out these directions in that kind of excruciating detail, you know, explaining how to work a car, how to figure out geographic directions, and then try and explain the directions to make this 4,000-mile journey or whatever. When you do that, what do you think the chances are that you got everything correctly, that your friend will be able to navigate this trip on the first try? It's almost impossible, and yet that's the kind of situation that a computer programmer faces every time.
Leonard Lee is my guest, and he's the author of the new book, The Day the Phones Stopped the Computer Crisis. Let's look at the kind of computer problems we're talking about in the context of the recent war in the Gulf, in which we relied so much on computer weapons, smart weapons. Tell us something about how it looks from the vantage point of your research.
Well, there's no doubt that most of the Pentagon weapons were a tremendous success in the Persian Gulf War and did a lot better than a lot of skeptics had predicted. And we saw the success of these laser-guided smart bombs and the stealth fighters and the cruise missiles, which really were an example of dazzling technology and how effective it is when it works. But a couple of stories didn't come out of the Gulf War. One is that the B-1 bomber, perhaps the most advanced weapon in the U.S. arsenal, never went to the Persian Gulf. Now, the Air Force tried to say it was because, oh, we need the bomber here at home to protect us in case the Russians attack. But really what the situation was that the Pentagon didn't send the bomber to the Gulf because it doesn't work. Ever since it first came off the assembly line, the B-1B has been plagued with a number of problems, mostly in its computer software. Its electronic defenses don't work, and the Pentagon, I think, was simply afraid to send it into that kind of a war environment. Also, even in one of the Pentagon's success stories, the Patriot missile, there was another side to that. The listeners might recall that in February, we had the situation where the Scud missile struck the barracks in Dahran and killed 28 Desert Storm Service personnel. The worst single day of casualties, I believe, in the Gulf War. And what happened was the Patriot missile system, which had worked so well to that point, failed to knock out the Scud because there was, yes, a small computer software glitch that caused the Patriot to shut down and ignore the incoming Scud missile. And so I think this just goes to show that the weapons can work very well, but again, you have to be prepared for problems now and then. And I think the situation is getting worse. There was a report out of ABC the other day that said the new B-2 stealth bomber is riddled with these types of software problems. There was a recent government study out that said 7 out of every 10 new Pentagon weapons coming down the line is experiencing software problems. And what does that mean? Well, likely it means the project will either be late, it will be over budget, or it will not work correctly when it's done, or a combination of the three. Earlier this year, the Pentagon canceled the A-12, which was to be the Navy's stealth attack plane. And part of the reason for the cancellation was that the contractors in this case simply could not develop the computer software needed to run these types of advanced weapons. And so I think we're seeing a situation where if the Pentagon doesn't get a handle on this, we're going to end up with a lot of weapons that are either very expensive when they do work or may not work correctly. And I don't think either situation is very good.
Leonard, let me ask you if you had any personal problems with computers that led you to write this book and do the research.
It's funny you should mention. I kind of ended up being bit by the hand that fed me, so to speak. I freely admit I wrote the book on my computer. That, you know, I couldn't have written it without a computer and the wonderful software programs that I have. And so that again shows you, you know, we can't do without computers. They are wonderful devices. But this computer did reach out and bite me. The week after I had finished it, I sent the manuscript into the publisher. And then the very next day, I turned on my computer, and the book was gone.
It
had been reduced into gibberish. The book had taken all the words and shuffled them together as if it had taken all my chapters and thrown them up in the air and caught them in a random order. And so it served as a good lesson to me, too, that these devices are wonderful, but every once in a while they're going to reach out and get you.
So sum up the cautionary advice that you have. You're not saying let's do away with computers.
Oh, not at all. You know, computers are great. They make our life so much better in everything they do. They make business more efficient. They make your personal life more efficient. They make our cars run more fuel efficiently and burn cleaner. As I said, we couldn't have modern air travel without them. No, I'm not suggesting in any way that we should do without computers. But what I am saying is we do have to keep a watchful eye on them. We can't rely on them for everything. And when we do use them, you always have to keep in the back of your mind, well, what happens if the computer fails? Too often, I think people are caught without having thought through that type of scenario. What we witnessed with the phones a couple weeks ago is a good example, that we're moving away from having any sort of a mechanical backup. We're just leaving everything to the computer. And that's great when it works fine, but when the computer goes down, well, you're sure they had a backup, but the backup turned out to be another computer. And so that's where you get into trouble. You always have to leave yourself open and leave yourself an out for what happens if the computer goes wrong. And we also need to do more on the technical end of it. There's no doubt that we need more research into how to write better computer software. There are some technologies out there where we do know how to write better software that's more reliable and safer. But I think we need to put more effort into that. There's a bill before Congress right now that would start to direct more federal funding for this type of research. And that's what I think we need is not only more attention to the problem, but we need to be devoting more resources to this before the situation kind of gets out of hand.
Leonard Lee, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you very much, Terry.
And Leonard Lee is a journalist and author of the new book, The Day the Phones Stopped, The Computer Crisis, The What and Why of It, and How We Can Beat It. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. A golf course may look like a natural part of the environment, but in Florida, the golf capital of America, the golf green is hardly indigenous. Coming up, John Strawn on the making of a golf course. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the piano sonatas of Mozart as interpreted by Yugoslavian pianist Dubravka Tomcic. And horror writer Stephen King is trying his hand at writing for TV. TV critic David Bianculli tells us what he thinks of King's new summer series, Golden Years. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Soviet leader Gorbachev has arrived in London ahead of tomorrow's meeting with leaders of the seven largest industrialized democracies in presentation of his latest economic reform plan. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports from London.
Gorbachev will meet tomorrow morning with President Bush and French President Mitterrand before his afternoon meeting with the G7 leaders. A copy of Gorbachev's plan obtained by the Associated Press quotes the Soviet president as having high hopes for the upcoming meeting in London. And the G7 political communique issued today expressed support for his economic reform efforts to date. But several G7 members, including the United States, have reportedly found Gorbachev's plan lacking and are reluctant to provide more aid unless there's evidence the Soviet reform process is irreversibly underway. Nonetheless, U.S. Secretary of State James Baker today said that Gorbachev won't leave London without something.
If you think back two or three years, you would have and considered whether or not the President of the Soviet Union would be attending an economic summit, you would probably have concluded no chance, and here he is.
The London summit officially ends tomorrow with the G7's economic declaration. I'm Michael Sullivan in London.
In Capitol Hill, the Senate Intelligence Committee has voted to delay confirmation hearings for Robert Gates to head the CIA until the middle of September. Committee leaders say that they will subpoena two former CIA officials and compel testimony by a third to find out if Gates knew more about the Iran-Contra scandal than he says he does. U.S. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney and General Colin Powell, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, have urged Senate approval of a treaty slashing conventional forces in Europe. The treaty was signed last December and must now be ratified by the Senate. NPR's Ann Garrels has more.
Cheney and Powell were preaching to the converted. During their appearance before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, there was virtually no opposition. But should there be any doubts, Powell said the Pentagon is confident the net military advantage of the pact belongs to NATO. Powell said the treaty will allow the NATO allies to defend the continent even if the Soviets cheat. Cheney urged the Senate to quickly ratify the treaty. He said it would mean the end of the enormous numerical superiority previously enjoyed by the Soviet Union over NATO. Meanwhile, U.S. and Soviet negotiators continue to wrestle with the last issue holding up a strategic nuclear arms reduction treaty and a superpower summit. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Former Philadelphia Mayor Frank Rizzo has died of an apparent heart attack in the midst of another campaign for mayor. He was 70 years old. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 7 points to close at 2,983.90 on volume of 183 million shares. This is NPR News. In the wake of the worst flooding in China in years, the government has called on the nation to be prepared for more hardship. According to state radio, leaders of the Communist Party say that the flood season has just started and China should be prepared for the worst. Officials ordered local leaders to take a commanding role in mobilizing the masses, and that flood damage is already estimated at more than $6 billion. The China News Service reports that disease in disaster areas is already spreading. In New York City, the UN Secretary General has proposed a plan for Iraq to pay the cost of its weapons of mass destruction. Linda Fasulo has more from the UN.
Last month, the Security Council passed a resolution that holds Iraq liable for the costs of its disarmament, costs estimated to run into the tens of millions of dollars, and it asked the UN chief to propose a plan. Pérez de Cuellar is now recommending that Iraq be allowed to sell enough oil to meet the costs but under close UN scrutiny, and the proceeds would be placed in a United Nations account. However, the proposal would require the lifting of sanctions in order for the sales to take place. A U.S. official says the plan seems plausible. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
An Iraqi official says that government officials in Switzerland have authorized Iraq to withdraw money from its formerly frozen bank accounts. The Minister of Commerce in Iraq says that Switzerland has released Iraqi funds and that $70 million has already been returned to Baghdad. Most of Iraq's assets are frozen in U.S. banks. The AAA says that the nationwide average price of self-service regular gasoline went up half a cent last week. It was the first increase in 6 weeks. According to the club, the average price is now $1.14 a gallon. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The Yugoslavian pianist Dubravka Tomsic came to the United States as a child prodigy and studied at Juilliard in the 1950s before returning to Europe. Lately, she's been reestablishing her career in America, both recording and performing. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz has a review of the latest Tomsic recording, a Mozart album.
With a few exceptions, Mozart's piano sonatas aren't usually taken as seriously as his other works for the piano. In fact, of his two piano pieces in C minor, the Fantasia and the Sonata, it's the Fantasia that's more highly regarded than the Sonata, which usually follows it. On Tomsic's new Mozart album, the Sonata has equal power, and together the two pieces have a tremendous impact. The revelation on this recording is Mozart's early sonata in E-flat, Kirchhoff 282. Mozart was 19 when he composed this strange work, and it doesn't get performed very often. It begins with a slow movement, and in the delicate fingers of Dubravka Tomsic, it turns out to be one of the great Mozart adagios. Tomsic captures the stoic, tears just below the surface simplicity that makes Mozart Mozart. She imbues the spaces between the notes with as much meaning as the notes themselves. The first theme keeps reaching up, fluttering, and then quietly resigning itself to falling back to earth. The second movement is an almost comically awkward little minuet that's also extraordinarily touching. The mechanism of the dance seems to keep the world running, though something sad, even tragic, seems ready to pounce at any moment. Thank you. The last movement is the shortest, a brief, joyful, nonstop allegro. Tomsich plays it as she plays everything, with a crystalline transparency that seems a window into the heart of the music. This is a marvelous recording, and one of the nicer things about it is that it's only volume one, which means that more volumes are on the way.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new album of Dubravka Tomsic performing Mozart on the Koch International label. This is Fresh Air. Florida is the golf capital of America. There are about 1,000 golf courses in Florida, more than anywhere else in the country. Palm Beach County alone has more golf courses than many states. Many of these courses are part of condominium developments, and many Floridians live on houses that adjoin a golf course. Golf is a driving force in the Florida real estate economy and a link to understanding the way of life for many people in South Florida. John Strawn is a former historian and an avid golfer. His new book, Driving the Green, The Making of a Golf Course, is a step-by-step account of the creation of one South Florida golf course, a course that is part of an expensive residential community. And by studying one golf course, Strawn has also uncovered something about architecture, nature, politics, and money.
Most golf courses now are built as part of residential real estate developments. The developers call them amenities. They're like a marina or a ski slope, tennis courts. They're mainly now engines to sell the real estate. It causes some problems in design. It makes frequently for golf courses that I don't like to play because they're narrow, they're constricted on either side by housing. The old courses, all you did was play golf on them, and I think they're more fun to play. But nobody can afford to build a golf course like that.
Can you describe a little more how golf courses are changing, the ones that are built in the middle of a housing development, how they compare with golf courses that are just golf courses standing on their own?
Well, I think the major difference is in what the golf course architects would call the routing. They have to try to maximize the number of house lots that are situated on the golf course. The way you do that is to have single fairways would be the maximum way of doing it. If you have houses lined on either side of every fairway, that would maximize the real estate. It would also make terrible golf. So frequently what they do as a compromise will have double fairways or parcels of fairways with housing around it. But the contemporary real estate design golf courses, they may be maintained better or as well. They may have green complexes and fairways and tees, which are equal to older courses, and maybe in some cases superior to. But for somebody like myself to play down a canyon of housing is not pleasant. I prefer the old courses where you can spray the ball around a bit, where what would be called a core course. But everything is the golf course. On these residential courses, there's out of bounds on either side. You're going to land in Harry's pool if you hit a bad shot.
Golf courses look like very well manicured, but otherwise, you know, fairly natural open green spaces. But you describe how really difficult it is to create that kind of landscape, especially in South Florida. Is that kind of lawn really alien to the natural environment there?
Oh, absolutely. There's nothing, I think, remotely like it. But that's true for not just for South Florida. It's more dramatic in South Florida, I think. South Florida is dead flat, and unlike other parts of the country where there's some features in the natural topography, everything, every hillock, every mound, every bit of movement in the ground in a South Florida golf course is created by the architect. That's part of the reason I wanted to write this book about a South Florida course, because the artifice would be so obvious. In South Florida, all the movement of the excavation of the lakes and the placement of the dirt, it just creates a landscape that clearly is not native. In addition to that, as you mentioned, you know, the grasses, you know, lawns are not really a natural feature of the landscape. In South Florida, the grasses that are used on golf courses are all hybrid Bermuda grasses, crosses between grasses that come from Africa, and there's nothing like them in nature at all, whether in a landscape or anywhere else.
South Florida has gotten so developed that the golf courses are among the only really open greenland left, aside from like the Everglades, but I mean in the developed parts.
Right.
And, you know, the golf courses are a kind of landscape that's pretty alien to the swampland, to the wetlands that they're built on. But what effect are the golf courses having environmentally on the area? Any?
Well, you know, they don't have to be.
It's preserving open space.
Right, that's right.
And yet it's a different kind of, you know, different kind of ecology than is natural to the area.
That's right. It's interesting. They don't have to compete with the wildlife. They don't have to compete with the environment in a terribly damaging way. Arthur Hills did a wonderful golf course on the southwest coast of Florida called Bonita Bay. What he did was to, instead of making the whole golf course a giant lawn of 120 acres from every tee to every green being lawn, he carefully placed the tees sort of adjacent to the wetlands, made them small, and then on a tee shot, the players are required to hit the ball out over a wild area, as it were, onto then a smaller lawn-like area, which constitutes the fairway. So Bonita Bay has perhaps 65 acres of maintained turf as opposed to the 120 or 130 acres that a typical course has. And in extreme cases, like a course I saw in Texas, one of the savings and loan boondoggle courses, which since it had unlimited money, felt free to just develop all the turf land it wanted, has 300 acres in turf, which is an absurdity. But it is possible to create a golf course which is not damaging, in fact, can enhance wildlife habitat. I think the permitting agencies, the biologists in the South Florida Water Management District or in U.S. Fish and Wildlife would love to be able to work with developers to assure some adequate protection of wildlife. But the whole system is kind of set up to see that doesn't happen. To what degree golf courses represent or sort of a villain in this piece is kind of hard for me to judge. I think compared to agriculture, for example, golf has been had a trivial effect on the environment of South Florida compared to sugar, for example. But I think it would be, I think it's in the long run, golf developers, architects, everybody in this business, they're going to have to be sensitive to these larger sort of issues. And that means they're going to have to accept playing on brown grass at certain times of the year, not putting a million gallons of water on the golf courses every day when water is a very precious commodity, and make those sorts of compromises. I mean, golf doesn't have to be played with on the perfect, pure lawns that American golfers have come to expect.
You're a golfer. How did writing this book change your feelings about the sport?
Well, I think they didn't really change my feelings that much about the sport of golf itself. I still find it wonderfully companionable. I love going out with my friends and playing. I play on public golf courses. I'm not a member of a country club, and I really prefer that for a whole bunch of reasons. I think there's a there's a tendency to confuse golf with kind of its management and its settings. And I think it's important to me not to sort of brush golf with the damaging tar of racism, sexism, of anti-Semitism, of all these things that are very much a part of the golf's heritage in the United States, but are not part of the game any more than the fact that universities also once practiced most of those social habits should be now scorned rather than admired as places of learning. So I love golf for the good things. I think it's really truly a democratic game in the place of its origin, that it is a game which I would like to see restored sort of to its democratic purity in the United States if we could.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I enjoyed it very much.
John Strawn is the author of Driving the Green, The Making of a Golf Course. Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, will you be covering the death of Frank Rizzo? He was running again for the mayor of Philadelphia, died of a heart attack earlier today.
We will be covering it, Terry. We're scrambling to get it into the show now. We also will be leading the program with a report from London on the meeting of the G7 nations and asking the question whether the Third World will lose out if the G7 begins to pay attention to the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. More on Mr. Gates, the president's nominee to be the head of Central Intelligence, and on that chemical spill in the Pacific Northwest that has poisoned a river.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A new summer series is premiering on TV tonight called Stephen King's Golden Years. Many of King's novels and short stories have been adapted for TV and movies, but this is the first time King has written an original story expressly for television. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
Before you start expecting a whole lot out of Stephen King's Golden Years, let me say right up front that it's by the same production team that brought us Pet Sematary and Creepshow. And although it's getting some good reviews, Golden Years is anything but golden. In its plot, and especially its characters, it's comic book stuff all the way, and not a very good comic book either. Take the mad scientist, for example. He's the guy who runs the top-secret facility, experimenting with mysterious chemicals without paying attention to the warnings of his interns. The scientist, played by Bill Raymond, is named Dr. Richard Todhunter, and he's stiff enough to be named Dr. Tabhunter.
Dr. Todhunter?
What is it?
I've got a red light on a secondary override.
Gentlemen, we have a green board.
I'm sorry, sir, but we don't.
Shut up, Reddy. You're an intern. That means you keep your eyes open and your mouth shut. Understand?
While Tabhunter, or Todhunter, is playing around in the lab, a 71-year-old man named Harlan Williams is a few doors away, trying to save his job as the plant janitor. His smarmy young boss wants him fired and thinks he's finally found the way to do it.
Sit down, Williams.
What do you want to see me about? This. I don't understand.
It means that when you took your last physical, you flunked the eye test. Your vision is now below the level set by the Department of Defense for civilian workers.
Well, before you can say The Incredible Hulk, or The Flash, or any other comic book story with the same plot, the laboratory explodes and the janitor is doused with chemicals. After being sent to a government hospital, Harlan and his wife Gina finally realize the chemicals are making him younger. That doesn't make a bad beginning for a sci-fi story, except that this beginning comes at the climax of the two-hour telemovie. CBS's own on-air ads, and even the teaser at the start of the show, make no secret about King's Fountain of Youth plot twist. So why drag it out until the literal last moment of the premiere episode? But hey, why get picky? There are plenty of other things to complain about. Keith Zarabajka, the young co-star on The Equalizer, doesn't look very convincing at all in his old man makeup. And except for Frances Sternhagen, who plays Harlan's wife, the performances in the pilot are all strictly by the book, by the comic book. There's Ed Lauder as the tough-talking general, Felicity Huffman as the sexy security chief, and, of course, Raymond's mad scientist, who makes Gene Wilder in Young Frankenstein look like a model of restraint. King wrote the first five scripts for Golden Years and the story for the final 2 hours, so this is all his fault. Expect a combination of The Fugitive and Damn Yankees, with a lot of Stephen King's usual trademarks thrown into the mix. Just whatever you do, don't expect too much. While the clichés fly in Golden Years, the story barely gets off the ground. Harlan gets young slowly, but Golden Years gets old fast.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. So, how are we doing? Call us on our toll-free listener response line and let us know what you think about Fresh Air. The number is 1-800-NPR-WHYY. That's 1-800-NPR-WHYY. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with Joan Tuohy and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
He came from humble beginnings, became a popular entertainer, and went on to win a political election by a landslide. No, we're not talking about Ronald Reagan. We're talking about Sonny Bono, and he's my guest on our next show. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.